It is my great pleasure this morning to introduce our speaker for this morning, Nick Day. Nick is a public school teacher. He's been doing that for several years, currently teaching at Balfour High School, I'm advised. He indicates to me that he has taught grades 7 and 8 for a number of years. Some of his insights from that he'll share with us this morning are from that time as well. He is very interested in public education, the public education system's role in social justice, and will speak to us this morning about the Saskatchewan government's new pronoun policy legislation. I'm going to turn it over to you now, Nick.
I'd just like to thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to come speak with you about this, and especially my friend Marina, who's a member of your community. She's a retired educator, and since I started my teaching career, Marina has been a real source of, I hope you won't be embarrassed to hear, Marina, a real source of wisdom and guidance for me, as we often will sit around our in-laws' living room, sort of loudly debating the issues facing the education system. So thanks so much for the opportunity. This issue that we'll talk about is, of course, dangerous and harmful to kids. But beyond that, it's also had a toxic impact on my workplace. So really, the opportunity to talk with a community that's engaged in questions of justice is a gift to me. And I have a lot of offloading I need to do, so you're my therapists for the day. Yeah. So my talk is about Bill 137, and I've sort of titled it here, Critical Understanding of the Parent Inclusion Discourse. And I chose two pictures to put on the front because I think they represent the main ideas that are buried in this parent inclusion discourse. On the left, it says, stop teaching boys that they can be girls. And what I think about that is that it says that this queer stuff is maybe fake. It says a lot of things, right? But one of the things it says is maybe they're teaching those kids something that's actually not real. Don't feed them that stuff. So it's, in other words, it's an attack on the idea that trans people exist, I think, right? And then on the right, this picture, a lot of the protest signs, I don't know if you can see it, is people holding signs that say, don't mess with our children. And that, I think, contains the idea that the education system has an agenda to attack parents or to somehow sideline parents or take away from parents. And that's why I chose those pictures. I think those are the two operative things that are happening. So what am I going to talk about? Quickly, I'll talk about what is Bill 137, just to help in case, hopefully it's not review for everybody, but just make sure everyone has a shared understanding. I'll share my thoughts about what I think Bill 137 implementation is actually going to look like on the ground from the perspective of inside schools. My thoughts about the expected impacts, how I think it will impact kids and the education system. I'll talk a bit about a deconstruction of this idea of parental rights. What do I think is really going on when they talk about parental rights? And lastly, and most importantly, what is being done or could be done to stop it? There are some assumptions behind what I'm saying. Three assumptions. One is that gender diversity is real, so trans people are real. So this is not the talk that's sort of about debating or convincing whether trans people exist. A second assumption I have in this talk is gender diversity and the idea of children exploring gender diversity or their sexuality freely. My assumption is there's nothing threatening or scary about that. There's no risks or dangers involved with that. And my third assumption is that public schools are, in their ideal form, are a very democratic public institution. And that it's good and proper for public schools to be part of establishing the goals for our society, and that it's okay if those goals don't necessarily reflect every individual opinion about what's moral or immoral. And I know that idea is, like many people would disagree with that idea, that that schools should can take a role that they don't necessarily agree with or can advocate a path that people don't agree with, that's challenging for some folks. But those are sort of where I'm coming from. And it's not, if those assumptions aren't shared, if not everyone here shares those assumptions, I'm not trying to dismiss your perspective or suggest that that's not valid. I think all three of those are very rich and important conversations to debate and get into the weeds on. It's just not sort of in the scope. I'd love to talk about everything for hours, but it's not in the scope of the talk. So, okay, so having said that, I'm a communication media teacher at Balfour. So I'm very interested in the concept of discourse, which I mean the systems of thought, knowledge, and communication that construct our experience of the world, and how these knowledges are part of power struggles. And that's very important for this talk, because I see Bill 137 as a fight over how we're going to construct our idea of gender and how we're fighting over control of the school system. What's the school system for? What direction is it going to go? What goals will it pursue? I'm involved in the teachers' union in a very active way, but I'm not speaking on their behalf today. It's very important to unions, especially during collective bargaining, that they not be their position, not my position, not be represented as their position. I taught grade 7-8 for several years, and that's relevant because that's an age when a lot of kids start to explore their gender identity, and it's very important to them at that age when they're going through these questions. And I included that picture of myself and my son, I think because the screen looked too white and I wanted some color in there, but maybe also because it shows that I'm a parent and troubles that idea that it's teachers against parents, right? Maybe that's why that's there. Okay, I want to start two personal stories from my teaching experience. And they're two stories with different outcomes, so I called it a tale of two gender experiences. In the first story, I'm going to show a brief clip from this documentary. What happened was, when I was teaching grade 7-8, I came across the health grade 8 health curriculum. Has some outcomes, learning goals about HIV/AIDS. And specifically, it says, you know, students should learn about and discuss and investigate how HIV/AIDS affects or affected communities, particular communities. And so, reading this curriculum from a queer-friendly perspective, to me it seems pretty glaringly, it's an invitation to talk about how did that disease, specifically due to stigma, due to social access to medicine, due to social exclusion, how did that disease impact the gay community? Seems like that invitation is buried in that curriculum if you're reading the curriculum from a queer-friendly perspective. So I wanted to show the kids this documentary, which is about men who survived the AIDS epidemic in San Francisco and the experiences they went through. And I wrestled with that decision because it's sort of it's an adult topic, and as you'll see from the clip I show, they talk about gay sex, and I worried a lot, is somebody going to complain or will people be upset? But I was really glad I did. So I'll show the trailer here. If you haven't seen it, I really recommend this show.
If you had a bus ticket, it better be saying San Francisco, because that was the place to come.
I think a lot of us came out here because we didn't quite fit where we were.
I like the people here. They just seem more open. And I always wanted to meet a nice blonde surfer.
You took a bunch of young men and said, have as much sex as you can have. How much sex would they have? A lot of sex. All of America was feeling very confident that you could be much more sexual, and that was okay.
'81 was a big year. That is when everything changed. I remember looking in the window of Star Pharmacy, and there were these little Polaroid photographs. Watch out, guys, there's something out there.
The first time I heard about AIDS, I think it was called the gay cancer. We had friends who were dying right at the beginning of the epidemic.
I was hanging blood one day in the hospital, and the infectious disease fellow came in and said, Eileen, why don't you put gloves on? We don't know what this is.
How are you getting it? Who are you getting it from? Who's giving it to who?
Everybody was reading the obituaries because they went from like this to like this.
Our principal response was food banks and care programs, and it was a response that America should be proud of.
It changed people's view of the gay community in a huge way.
Again and again, in every situation, there's lesbians there leading the fight.
None of my friends are around for the beginning, so I want to tell their story as much as I want to tell my story.
Okay, so you can see why, maybe you could see why I was a bit nervous to talk about that and show that with grade eights. But I needn't have been, because there were no complaints, and the students responded to it in a really active and engaged way. And so what happened is, a student who was trans told their counselor at the school they'd now decided to come out because... Hi, Dan. Because... They said that the teachers all through school had been, it's not that they'd been homophobic, but there had never been a teacher who brought these issues into the class so matter-of-factly, like, it's no big deal, just comfortable. And that made them feel the school environment was safe, so they'd decided to come out for the first time. So that's a success story of what, if teachers are comfortable queering the classroom, the kind of environment it can create and the safety that it can create. And that particular kid had a very supportive family, and family wasn't an issue. And I think, students come out when that type of thing is signaled in the environment, right? The second story is about a student I've been aware of in my own teaching career. I use very vague language because it's important to not accidentally identify, you know, even which year did I teach the student. A student I've been aware of who... was trans and told their parents, and they weren't allowed to live at home anymore. And so when I knew them at school, they were living in a third-party, agency. And parents just couldn't... I think probably were working gradually on getting over it, but this kid had gone through the trauma of being rejected by your parents, living away, the isolation. It wasn't a good place to live. So now, in that kid's situation, they did choose to tell their parents, but other kids, you know, with the legislation that's come through, would choose not to tell their parents and might live at home in the closet, and if they lose the positivity at the school environment, so that's the one saving grace for the kid in situation number two, is that at school, their pronouns were recognized, no questions asked, right? So we don't know how important that simple fact at school might be for that kid who had been rejected by their parents, right? So two personal stories. I said to start, but I'm already 15 minutes in. That was supposed to be the start. So I'm going to quickly go through what is Bill 137. There's three phases. I'll summarize this very briefly. Phase one is the Ministry of Education released a policy. The ministry has the authority to just make policies that school divisions must follow. And this was one of them. And the policy said, this was in August 22nd, the policy said schools, three things essentially. Schools can't have outside agencies present to students on sex ed topics, and that was sort of targeted at Planned Parenthood. Secondly, schools or teachers have to notify parents before any lessons or activities that have to do with sex ed or gender, so parents can have the option to withdraw their kid during those learnings. And third, teachers cannot refer to students by a different name or pronoun than the one on their paperwork unless they seek parental permission first. And school divisions pretty much immediately announced that they'll comply with these instructions, which I kind of found surprising. I naively maybe expected a little bit, finally this will be the thing that a school division will put their foot down, but that was naive. Phase two is the injunction. So the government was sued and the school divisions were sued by UR Pride and EGAL Canada, which is a queer advocacy group. And the lawsuit claimed that the policy was unconstitutional because it targeted kids, specifically queer kids. And the Minister of Education kind of gave the game away, because in the news he said, somebody asked him, well, what if Jeremy just wants to be called Jerry? Does that count as a name change? He said, no, because it doesn't affect his gender. It's only if Jeremy wants to be Joan. Which then legally provided the basis to say, okay, so you're saying you've done a policy just to attack queer kids, right, or trans kids. So they sued the government and they asked for an injunction, saying, while you figure out if this policy is constitutional or not, can the courts please block it with an injunction so schools can't implement this in the meantime? And the judge granted that injunction. So I kind of call that phase two. And then phase three, and that's just some wording from the judge's injunction decision. The judge decided that the evidence was that youth would suffer irreparable harm or could suffer irreparable harm if this policy was followed. And I think the example I used of the kid who was kicked out of their house, then maybe losing the supportive school environment is kind of the, you can picture the irreparable harm, right? And then phase three is the nuclear legislation. So the government is very tactical, and seeing that the injunction had been granted, I think they interpreted that to mean, okay, there's a good chance that this lawsuit won't go our way. So they pivoted, they fainted, and they withdrew their original policy. So that's no longer in effect. It's not quite the order they did it, but they passed legislation using Section 33 of the Constitution, which says whatever we said in the policy, we're now going to put it into legislation. And because of this section of the Constitution, even if a court finds it unconstitutional, that legislation will still stand. So that's why it's called the notwithstanding clause. Notwithstanding any decision that it's unconstitutional, we're still allowed to do it. And many people, when they withdrew the first policy, they said, is the government backing down? But it was confusing for folks. No, it was a feint, right? It was like, we're going to lose that, so let's pivot to this, and we have a nuclear option over here. Does that make sense? Okay, so that's the three phases, and that's left us where we are. So that's now law. They passed it. And so our school division said, well, it's legislation. We're going to follow it. Again, I'm not convinced that they had to take that decision, but they are convinced they had to take that decision. So what will it do? The short answer is, in schools, what it'll actually look like is very, like, at least in Regina, I know what the Regina Public Division has decided, it'll be very minimal implementation. So what it'll look like is, yes, teachers will call home if a kid says, call me Joan instead of Jeremy, and they'll notify the parents. However, nobody at the school division is checking to see if that's being followed. That will come to a conflict only if a parent calls the school division office to complain, right? So it's kind of a very passive, minimal implementation. And that, I think, is sort of a positive. It's an incomplete win. Definitely teachers will not be inviting sexual health experts into the class, which is a major loss for the sexual health literacy of our province. And teachers will be sending a letter at the beginning of the year to parents saying, these are the following are the sex health topics we'll address this year. You have the option to pull your kid out. But it's sort of insincere, because it's not we're doing it tomorrow, it's we're doing it at some point this year. So it's minimal compliance, and it's nice. I would prefer non-compliance, but there it is. And I do think many teachers will completely ignore the rules, and it most often will not ever come back to bite them, because the complaints, I think, will be rare. But what are the impacts? So over the years, schools have become an increasingly more welcoming, safe, and positive environment for gender diversity, and students have been coming out a lot more because of that. That process, I think, will be reversed. That will roll back. I hate to sound melodramatic, but it's really not. Some students will suffer and die, because the social science evidence is that when you're not validated and welcomed for who you are, A, you don't learn, so your school experience will suffer, but you also become isolated, you suffer increased risk of mental health challenges, and kids, remember, like, might know that they're queer, but also be young enough to internalize the shame and the confusion of, is there something bad about me? Is there something wrong with me? Right? I think about that kid whose parents rejected them, right? At that age. We do know from social science that there will be higher rates of self-harm and suicide for those kids. Students in danger at home who need that safe refuge at school might miss out on that. And then the teacher side of it. Teachers are already kind of nervous about sex ed. You remember, like I said, I thought about this a lot, and I was nervous to show that documentary, which turned out to be such a fruitful and rich process. Many teachers haven't thought about this as much, and they'll be very nervous. They already are nervous, and they will, I think, unfortunately withdraw from these topics, sort of skirt these topics as much as they can. And so that's a loss for the quality of education. So I kind of out of time, but I wanted to really, my main sort of priority was to deconstruct this idea of parental inclusion, because I think when the government makes these policies, they tell the public how to think and how to talk about it. And in this case, they told us it's about parental inclusion. I think they choose that discourse because it's a common sense win, because who wouldn't be in favor of parents being included in their children's lives, right? But that's not, in fact, I would argue, it's not, in fact, what it's about at all. So first, I want to make the argument that actually this legislation is an attack on parents, in my way of viewing things. Because if you remember, one of my original assumptions is that trans people are real. Trans kids do exist. Given that trans kids exist, you've got parents in a situation that are not familiar with with gender topics and are scared about gender topics. I think we have grown up in a society where for a long time, like a lot of dads and moms too, but I think it's a lot about dads often, have witnessed the bullying of effeminate boys when they were kids, the bullying of queer or gay boys when they were kids, and have been terrified themselves as young people of being bullied or not being manly, right? I'm just doing it from a male masculine perspective. And I think those parents are coming at this issue from a place of deeply internalized terror and fear of the suffering that their kid might endure as a result of the intolerance and heteronormativity of our world, right? But unfortunately, I think with confusion, with fear, that can turn into anger. And we know people, I think most of us have known at some point, whether in person or otherwise, somebody like Jair Bolsonaro who said, "I'd rather have a dead son than a gay son." I don't think that's truly true. I don't think any parent wants their child to suffer or die. But I think some people convince themselves that they really feel that way, and it's mostly because of that deep fear turning into anger. So the reality for those parents that are afraid is that they're going to confront the situation with their kid. They're going to, like that student I mentioned who had to live away, they're going to drive their kid away, and that parent will suffer from losing the relationship with their child. Of course the child suffers, right? But also the parent suffers, and they never get to have a positive relationship with their child as they truly are. So I see this legislation as an attack on those parents, because where the school system and the government could be helping in the process of healing from that pain and hatred and suffering, instead they're driving a wedge and taking advantage of that fear and kind of trying to convince those parents, no, you're right to be angry, and you should be angry at those teachers because they're doing this to you. Your kid isn't actually like this. It's not real. So let's stop that process. I think that's the dog whistle that's being signaled to these parents. So I say that by way of deconstructing parent inclusion, because if you take for granted that queer people exist, I think the argument is that this policy is an attack on those parents, and it's, those parents will suffer as well. The other things that this is about is the governing party lost ground in two by-elections to an extreme right-wing party, and they wanted to signal we can be extreme social conservatives too. Like I said, they do want to blow an anti-queer dog whistle, meaning they want to signal to people, kids aren't really queer, teachers are grooming your kids, and we can shut that process down. And third, they want to play into the accountability movement, which is a movement that is really worth researching in education. It's a movement that's been around for, I guess, 30 to 40 years now, saying that of extreme right-wing parties who have an anti-public service agenda, they want to privatize health, education, social housing, whatever it might be. And as it comes to education, education is like a $4 trillion a year industry worldwide. It's a huge opportunity for private businesses that's not available to private businesses right now because it's mostly a public service, right? And so these right-wing parties who have an interest in privatizing that have been working for 40 years in various ways to educate the public to believe that public school teachers are harming their kids, failing their kids, failing society. So this took many forms. The standardized testing craze was one form of this. Standardized testing was used to demonstrate that public schools were failing, and then used as justification to privatize lots of public schools, especially in the States. So I do see this issue as, in a way, as being a continuation of the accountability movement, because it picks up on that idea of public teachers are harming you. Public teachers are not doing a good job. They're acting against your interests. You got to be worried about what public schools are doing, and we got to do something about that. Pardon me. So this policy and this legislation, I think, is part of undermining trust in public schooling. And it's no coincidence that it's happening at a time when teachers are bargaining. We're in the strongest collective bargaining sort of position that we've been in a long time, and are likely to go on strike soon, mostly over two issues: funding, properly funding the public education system, so like smaller class sizes, basically, and teacher autonomy, and codifying or entrenching in our collective agreement the idea that teachers have the autonomy to make some of these decisions about what we're doing with the curriculum, right? So there's no coincidence that this happens at that time. I've gone way over time. What can be done to stop it? There's lots being done. What I would encourage anybody to do who isn't a teacher is the school division is the main actor that could at this point stop this. The government will not be convinced. They're all in on this legislation. School divisions are unlikely, I think, to be convinced to do much about this, because they tend to view it as there's an authority structure, right? The government passes legislation, we have to do it. I personally believe this legislation is in a very weak position. The court case may, a judge may still rule that the legislation is unconstitutional. We know it will still stand because of that notwithstanding clause, but it's significant if the judge says it's unconstitutional, right? Secondly, like I mentioned, the minimum implementation. School divisions don't really want to do much for this policy, so there's not a lot of will behind it. And third, the government, I think, stepped into a kind of a hornet's nest that they didn't intend. They thought this would be a quick, cheap political points, and I think, genuinely, I sensed they were shocked by the amount of blowback they've gotten, and myself and Marina's daughter and some other teachers, we penned a petition saying, you know, we're teachers of Saskatchewan who will absolutely not follow this legislation in our classroom practice. And 100 odd teachers around the province in 14 different school divisions signed on to this petition. And it was thrilling to see this sort of noncompliance. And it triggered a journalist to ask the government, what are you going to do if teachers don't follow this? And it was either Scott Moe or the Minister of Education said, you know, we just kind of hope they'll follow it, and it'll be up to school divisions how they enforce it. And that, I believe, signals that they had no intention of really fighting this fight, right? And for those reasons, I think the legislation is in like a weak place. As strong as it is, it's in a weak place in some ways. And what could make the difference is voters who are parents or grandparents or any stakeholder in the education system simply calling the school division, and sort of the school division is extremely sensitive to calls from the public. I don't really know why, but they're very, very afraid of parents. And usually the calls they get from parents maybe are pushing the other direction. So it certainly wouldn't hurt for them to be receiving a lot of calls. So something everybody can do is talk to the parents you know and grandparents you know and community. You don't have to be a parent. You just can call and say, and share your thoughts about what they're doing, and it may help push them the other way. I'm so sorry I went way over time. I hope that's all right. Yeah. Okay, thanks for listening. Which day? Yeah.